Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We can now tell you what Ben Bernanke plans to do about interest rates in the medium-term future, even though he never gave his testimony this morning at a congressional hearing that never happened. The snowy politics of monetary policy today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by PBS, presenting Faces of America with Henry Louis Gates Jr., Meryl Streep, and Stephen Colbert, who dig into their family trees tonight at 8, 7 Central on PBS. And by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 10th of February today. Today, Ben Bernanke managed to leave Congress out in the cold, so to speak, and yet still get his message across to investors here and abroad. The Fed chairman's testimony before the House Financial Services Committee was postponed on account of all that snow. That, of course, meant no questions from all those pesky lawmakers. But Bernanke saw to it that his written statement, prepared remarks, they're called, was released anyway, just so he didn't miss the opportunity to start the delicate task of bracing Wall Street for what lies ahead. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more now on Ben's break it to me gently, baby strategy.
It's not that veteran floor trader Ted Weisberg of Seaport Securities is complaining. He appreciates the way Bernanke is carefully telegraphing his strategy to gradually tighten the money supply. Weisberg just doesn't recall this kind of openness in his nearly half century on Wall Street.
I think it's kind of unusual. I guess it's good. Listen, the more transparency, the more people have time to digest the news, the less of a knee-jerk reaction you will get at many different levels, including the stock market.
At Potomac Research Group, former Fed Governor Lyle Gramley says Bernanke isn't just looking to score popularity points by signaling his intentions this way. He's purposely moving the markets.
Back when I was a governor, back in the early 1980s, the theory was that you ought to surprise markets. Theory now says that what you ought to do is try to be as communicative as possible. If you can inform financial markets where monetary policy is likely to go, then financial markets will price assets in ways that help you get your results you want.
Bernanke's statement offered assurances that he's got an exit strategy ready. But former Fed Monetary Affairs Director Vincent Reinhardt says it was carefully crafted to send a simultaneous message that the time is not yet appropriate.
So he's letting that big truck behind him called financial markets know that at some point the car was going to slow down. So he just tapped on the brakes.
Reinhardt, who's now with the American Enterprise Institute, says trying to talk the markets in the direction you want can be risky. They can start worrying about too much talk.
The thing about talking is you have to make sure you actually follow through with it. It's not an independent instrument, but it is something you can do to amplify the power of the instruments you do have.
If it sounds as if Bernanke is trying to orchestrate what the markets do, well, now you've got the picture. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I got an email from a friend of mine on the East Coast today. He said the snow has done such damage to government services that he and his neighbors had to chip in to pay some guy to come plow their street. That got us thinking about the snow economy and how people get by when they can't get around. Amity Jeans is the assistant manager at Fager's Hardware Store in Washington. Amity, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
So how is business on this crazy day?
It has been steady. We are absolutely amazed at the number of brave souls who have trekked through this blizzard to get here, just to get a shovel, just to get firewood.
I imagine windshield scrapers are gone, snow melting ice is gone, all that stuff.
All the ice melt is gone. We have another tractor trailer coming in tomorrow. We just cannot keep up with the demand. We get a tractor trailer in an hour, it's gone.
You hope that tractor trailer comes, right? I mean, there's still 4 feet of snow on the roads.
Well, we're hoping. It has to come from upper northeastern Pennsylvania, Allentown. It's a long schlep. And we sent one of our crew, Apollo, to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, to one of our manufacturers to pick up a load of snow shovels. And what was normally a 2.5 hour one-way trip, or, you know, 5 hours round trip, took 14 hours.
Oh, man.
But again, we just can't keep up with demand.
Yeah, but who's providing all that demand? I mean, the pictures I see, Capitol Hill is just deserted.
Capitol Hill is very much a community. There are a lot of families that live here. We're even getting people in from Virginia and Maryland who have driven all over the place out in their areas and can't find anything, so they've come here.
I read the weather report says you guys are due for another storm on President's Day. Are you ready for that?
I think at this point we can take about anything that's thrown at us.
You've been there, what, 10, 15 years, plus or minus?
I've been here 13 years.
Is this the worst you've ever seen?
This is the worst that I've seen in my tenure at the hardware store. It's amazing. It's quite a bit of snow. We're not used to it all at once like this.
Let me ask you this. How is your staff getting it? I imagine it's no small effort for them.
Well, most of us live close by. We also, I think, for the most part, consider this play. You know, we come to work and we're very lucky we don't have to sit behind desks.
Who's that laughing in the background?
That's
there?
My staff. They're eating pizza right now and they are happy, and we come to work and we play.
Now, wait a minute. Did you guys get pizza delivered today?
We did, and I cannot give out the name of the place. I would love to, but they said that they would not be doing deliveries today. But since we buy so much pizza from them, they would do it for us.
All right. You guys closing early at all or no?
No, we're regular hours, 7 to 7.
Terrific. Emily Jeans, the assistant manager at Frager's Hardware on Capitol Hill in Washington. Emily, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
On to the rest of the news. Toyota continues to have lots of explaining to do about its recalls. But before the explaining, the company is doing some apologizing. So we asked Marketplace's Rico Galliano to look into the history of corporate mea culpas to see how Toyota might stack up.
Toyota's ad opens with shots of happy Toyota owners through the years and segues into shots of a modern production line.
In recent days, our company hasn't been living up to the standards that you've come to expect from us.
The ad's being broadcast everywhere, just about all the time. But in the 1980s and 90s, apologies like these were rare. So says Kit Yarrow. She's a psychology and marketing professor at Golden Gate University.
There's such a fear of lawsuits that I think actually a lot of CEOs and a lot of companies might like to have apologized, but were counseled against it.
But with the internet making it easy for angry consumers to vent, silence has become deadly for corporations. Gene Grabowski is with Levick Strategic Communications, and he recalls the 2008 case of Westland Hallmark, the biggest beef recall in history.
When they did apologize, it was too late. And they didn't speak out publicly until they were testifying before Congress, and the company went out of business.
So that's how not to say I'm sorry. A more successful example, Mattel. Back in 2007, they were called unsafe toys. CEO Bob Eckert posted a personal apology online.
As a parent of four children myself, I know that absolutely nothing is more important than the safety and well-being of children.
But Golden Gate University's Kit Yarrow says Toyota's apology lacks Mattel's punch.
But it's a very emotional ad with the music and tone of voice and historical pictures. But ultimately, what we don't have is a person taking responsibility and saying what went wrong.
If she's right, the ad's creators may be preparing an apology to Toyota. I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Even though he never actually opened his mouth, Ben Bernanke helped take some of the air out of Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Google CEO Eric Schmidt had an op-ed in the Washington Post today. He says we're not innovating enough in this country. Of course, his company's innovations, or what Google's been able to do with other people's innovations, have put it right at the center of almost every part of our internet experience, from the videos we watch to the emails we send and, obviously, to the search engine we use to look stuff up. So maybe it was just a matter of time before Google got into the ISP business, that is, Internet Service Provider. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
In a blog post on its website, Google sketched out its plan to deliver internet access to as many as 500,000 homes. Google says it would be 100 times faster than what most people have today. Fast enough to download a full-length, high-definition movie in less than 5 minutes. Doug Williams is an analyst with Forrester Research.
It will allow those things that are kind of painful to do today, it will make that experience much more palatable.
And maybe more competitive. Google says it will allow other service providers to use its network, but maybe not out of the goodness of its heart.
Google makes more money when more people are on the internet using Google products.
Ben Scott is policy director for Free Press, a nonprofit public interest group.
I think what they're trying to do is demonstrate that there's a marketplace for these applications that use super fast networks because they want to sell stuff in that market.
But other analysts question whether there is enough of a market for super speedy internet service. Analyst Mike Paxton with Instat says only a small percentage of people use the bandwidth they have now.
So you're talking about, you know, 100 times faster. You're going to have to say, well, do we even need that much?
Others raise concerns about Google owning too many links in the internet chain, including how it's delivered. They say it could restrict competition and raise privacy issues. But so far, it's just an experiment on a small scale. Right now, the Federal Communications Commission is developing a national broadband plan. Free Press's Ben Scott says Google could help set the bar for the kind of speed and openness regulators should be aiming for. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If you were listening real close up at the very top of the show, you might have picked up on a new PBS documentary that premieres tonight. Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates has been working on a project called Faces in America, using genealogy and DNA testing to track the shared American experience. NBC is working on a new genealogy show, too, called Who Do You Think You Are?, using celebrities to tell the story. But it's not just celebrities and professors who think genealogy is cool. Knowing where you came from is becoming quite a business. Megan Smolenyak is a genealogist by profession. Welcome to the program.
Good to talk to you as well.
Is there a way to figure out exactly how big genealogy is?
You know, it's hard to get some really hard and fast numbers, but just to give you some indication, Ancestry.com, which is the largest company in the industry, just went public last November, and in the last quarter, their subscription rate soared about 17%.
So even though the economy is tricky, people are still willing to plop down 20 or 30 bucks a month for a site subscription?
You know, it seems so. I'm wondering if it isn't perhaps one of those fields that's slightly recession-proof in the sense that when times are hard, people tend to return to basic values and family, and this fits right in there. And comparatively speaking, it's a very affordable hobby.
Is there a way for you to judge how sticky this is? I mean, people get curious for a month or two, and then it sort of goes away?
Do you know, it actually is very addicting. What happens usually is people will get interested, maybe, say, their parents' 50th wedding anniversary is coming up. So they think they'll dabble a little bit. But then once they find out something they didn't know before, they become curious. And it becomes your own personal history mystery, and you just keep on chasing clue after clue after clue.
Now, obviously, for you, things are going pretty well. You've worked with Dr. Gates on his program, and you've worked with the NBC show. But generally speaking, how is business for genealogists out there?
Overall, the field is going gangbusters. I mean, the fact that there are going to be not one but two primetime genealogy television series tells you something about it.
What else do you guys do, though? I mean, it can't all be help me find out who my great uncle four times removed was.
No, there's all sorts of applications. I mean, for instance, I have a contract with the U.S. Army where I track down the families of soldiers who are still unaccounted for from old conflicts. There are groups of genealogists who help coroner's offices track down the next of kin for people whose identities are known but who sadly are unclaimed. So there are a lot of different applications for genealogy.
Is there a difference in the kind of genealogy you do? I mean, there's the search for ancestors, right? And then there's the search for living family.
Yeah. Back when I started, people were only interested in the dearly departed, but now there's much more interest in connecting with the living relatives as well. And one of the great things with the internet and with DNA, too, it's possible now not only to find those second, third, and fourth cousins, but even those 12th and 15th cousins. I can show up in Ireland or Slovakia and be treated like family.
Well, speaking of showing up in Ireland or Slovakia, I mean, people actually invest money in finding their ancestors. They take these trips. They spend a whole bunch of money doing this.
If people can find out what town their ancestors are from, they'll spend the money and they'll come and they'll visit repeatedly. You'll actually find people buying homes in the villages where their ancestors once lived. So there is this whole sort of sub-industry of genealogical tourism.
Is it a little bit, though, like the airline industry or the travel agent industry, I guess, right? That the rise of technology and the ease of me doing it myself might take you guys out of the loop somehow?
There's some truth to that. Everybody likes to chase their own stories, but inevitably people will hit brick walls at some point in the course of your research, and that's when they'll end up turning to the professionals.
Megan Smolenyak, she is a professional genealogist. Megan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up, when some parts of Washington were way off limits.
Forget about trying to get a cab back, like calling a cab to come down here at 4 or 5 in the morning. They would never do it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average trimmed 20 points today, 0.2%, ended things at 10,038. The NASDAQ coughed up 3 points, 0.1%, finished at 2147. The S&P 500 sliced off 2 points, 0.2%, closed at 1,068. Sprint Nextel dumped nearly 8% today. The mobile telephone operator reported a fourth quarter loss. The New York Times crumpled 9%. Gray Lady reported fourth-quarter earnings that beat expectations, but its revenue still fell 11.5%. Coca-Cola fizzled 4.3% despite reporting fourth-quarter earnings that beat expectations. The price on the 10-year T-note fell today. More, I should say. It pushed the yield up. 3.69% is the number you're looking for, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday, or not. Due to inclement weather, the Commerce Department has postponed the release of its retail sales report covering January. The Senate Armed Services Committee has canceled a hearing on the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. It will be rescheduled later. What has survived the storm? Survivor! The reality show enters its 20th season tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The healthcare story this week hasn't really been healthcare as such, mostly because the overhaul bill is pretty much stuck. Instead, an insurance company out here in California has gotten most of the attention, Anthem Blue Cross, and its amazing rate increase. As luck would have it, lucky for us, that is, not necessarily for him, commentator Robert Reich is an Anthem customer.
I've had the same problems with Anthem that most people have with their health insurers. Confusing bills, copayments, and deductibles that never seem to add up. They seem more interested in fighting me than helping me. But now Anthem Blue Cross is going a step further with the increase in premiums as much as 39%. That's 15 times the rate of inflation. Anthem says it has no choice. The recession has forced so many policyholders to drop coverage because they can't afford it that Anthem has to spread its costs over a much smaller pool. And too many of those remaining policyholders have greater medical needs than the average. That sounds logical, but it's at odds with the soaring profits of Anthem's corporate parent, WellPoint. Anthem's argument is also questionable, given that the firm has been among the most aggressive opponents of the health care bills passed by the House and Senate. These bills would add tens of millions of Americans to insurance pools, thereby spreading the costs over more people and avoiding the very problem Anthem says is now forcing it to raise its rates so much. Anthem obviously believes it can raise its rates this much and not lose every one of its remaining customers with average medical needs, which suggests Anthem doesn't face very much competition. Insurers, remember, are exempt from the federal antitrust laws, and WellPoint, Anthem's parent, is the largest insurer in America. Anthem is a microcosm of our private for-profit health insurance system, the most expensive in the world, whose costs are rising faster than anywhere in the world and rapidly becoming unaffordable to more and more Americans, and lobbying like mad against reform. Anthem is also one of the best arguments for reform. What can be done in the meantime? A few days ago, HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius urged Anthem to disclose to policyholders how much of their premiums are going to profits, administrative overhead, and advertising instead of covering medical claims. Well, I know what I'm going to do. Next chance I get, I'm switching to another insurer. If I can, if that makes any difference.
When he's not fighting with his insurance company, Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Drop us a line if you've got some thoughts to share. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. For the first time in about 15 years, mental health professionals have a new guidebook. It's called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Catchy, I know. It lists the official diagnoses that can be applied to our various problems. A draft of the fifth edition of the DSM hit the internet today. Not a huge deal for lay people, but for drug companies and insurance companies and researchers, the DSM isn't just a guide to disorders. It's a manual for how to make money. Gregory Warner reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia.
To get a new drug approved by the FDA, pharmaceutical companies have to show there's a legitimate problem that it's meant to treat. If it's a mental disorder, that diagnosis, with rare exception, must be listed in the DSM. Michael First is a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia. He helped edit the previous version of the manual. That manual introduced a new diagnosis, social anxiety disorder, which applied to millions of potential new sufferers. As a result,
as soon as it's in the DSM, it greatly facilitates their ability to argue to the FDA that this is a legitimate use of my new medication.
The FDA agreed. GlaxoSmithKline built their ad campaign for Paxil, an SSRI and antidepressant, around the new diagnosis.
Some of the pharmaceutical companies started believing that SSRIs, which were already in their pipeline, might be helpful for social anxiety disorder.
The proposed DSM-5, released this morning on the internet, includes its own new names, expanded diagnoses for binge eating, a diagnosis for hypersexuality. Insurance companies use the DSM as a guide to what treatments they'll pay for. Ed Cook is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Illinois at Chicago, one of the authors of the DSM-5.
If I put in a claim for a treatment or even a diagnostic visit without some kind of code, the insurance company is going to go, well, what are you doing here?
When something's listed in the DSM, it also invites new funding for research and clinical trials. The draft of the DSM-5 is open for public comment until April, giving people who get those diagnoses a chance to weigh in. People like Philip Doughty, who blogs under the name Furious Seasons.
It's a victory for the consumer or the patient movement to even have us, you know, considered.
He's waiting to see whether his suggestions get heard. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
The streets may be largely deserted in Washington, D.C. today, but underneath all that snow, the nation's capital is hopping. Not only is there a new or new-ish administration in town, but the bad old days when Washington's murder rate was the highest in the country and the mayor was busted for smoking crack with a prostitute, they all seem like a long time ago. Brett Neely explains.
It's karaoke night at the Rock and Roll Hotel in Washington's Northeast District. The sing-along has drawn a lot of tattooed hipsters. But just 5 years ago, you couldn't beg a cab to take you to this neighborhood in Northeast Washington, says club manager Evan Preller.
And forget about trying to get a cab back, like calling a cab to come down here at 4 or 5 in the morning. They would never do it.
Now, Preller says, bars, restaurants, and expensive condos have replaced the empty storefronts and abandoned buildings. Newcomers are driving the transformation. So many people have landed in D.C. in the last decade that its once declining population is set to pass 600,000 for the first time in 20 years. And that's thanks to an expanding federal government.
Oh, Annie emailed me today.
Mm-hmm. One new Washingtonian is Andy Lipstein. I spoke to her as she was making dinner with her fiancé. Okay. After finishing her master's degree in public policy last summer, she moved here and started working for the Federal Centers for Disease Control. Lipstein thought she would work for a small nonprofit organization in some other part of the country. But when she went looking for a job, all roads led to Washington.
I think almost half my class is in Washington, and that's not typical.
In addition to government workers, the region has always attracted law firms and lobbying shops. But in the past decade, media, telecom, and financial services firms diversified the region's economy, says Marjorie Turner, a demographics expert at the Urban Institute.
That gives the district a huge advantage over some other cities around the country where the economic anchor was once manufacturing, and that economic anchor is declining in size, importance, and vitality.
Many companies are now expanding here as President Obama tries to channel resources into new areas like renewable energy. And as the government steps up efforts to regulate, lots of financial services companies have bulked up their D.C. offices. That's driving up rents. Office space in Washington is now nearly as expensive as in New York, says Mitchell Shear. He's president of Vornado Charles E. Smith, one of the biggest commercial real estate firms in town.
If companies aren't necessarily relocating here right now, they are for sure putting their hooks a little bit deeper, putting some more people here.
Those newcomers are enjoying a higher standard of living thanks to the local government's efforts. It lured big chains like Target and Best Buy to the district, which had very little shopping. And aggressive policing has cut crime. But even as the quality of life has improved, long-time D.C. residents have suffered. Mary Spencer was born and raised in D.C. She grew up right around the corner from where the Rock and Roll Hotel stands and lived in the same house for almost all of her 65 years.
When we first moved into our house, it was an all-white neighborhood, and we were the first black family to move on that street.
She watched the neighborhood go downhill and improve again as the city recovered. But gentrification brought a shocking jump in property taxes. They more than doubled. Spencer and her husband decided they couldn't afford to live there anymore.
I think the stores that have come in the various areas are wonderful, but, you know, at whose expense?
Last year, they rented the house to a British couple and moved deep into suburban Maryland. She likes the new D.C., except for the fact she can't afford to live in it. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information is at massmutual.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note today, a quick one, as an addendum to Bob Moon's report earlier about the Fed and where the economy might be going. Credit Suisse said today that American debt, government and private, is riskier than debt in Kazakhstan. Think about that for just a second. And while you do, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 20 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ lost 3 points, that's 0.1%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, 0.2%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gortz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on our program, Balancing Capitalism with Compassion.
Economists are interested in how to make the pie larger. Theologians are interested in how to divide the pie.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.